Welcome to Shoot Like a Girl, a podcast featuring interviews with extraordinary military women from around the world who push their limits on and off duty. I'm your host, Kate Stewart, and this is episode number 39. Today's guest is Captain Erin Edwards. Although she earned her civilian pilot's license at a young age, Captain Erin Edwards started her military journey as a naval warfare officer in the Canadian Naval Reserve. Later, she transitioned to the regular force, where she realized her dream of becoming a Griffon pilot, ultimately being selected as a member of 427 Special Operations Aviation Squadron. Simultaneously, Captain Edwards demonstrated her commitment to lifelong learning by successfully completing her master's degree in space science. Now, Erin has taken on an exciting new role as the Canadian Astronaut Coordination Officer, and she also serves as CAPCOM and Mission Control at NASA's Johnson Space Center. Ready to get started?
Sure.
Erin, thank you so much for being here today. I know we've had a lot of back and forth trying to get our schedules to mesh, but it finally happened. So I'm super excited for this.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me. Just like I'd mentioned before, you've had some total rock stars on your show. So I appreciate being invited to be amongst them, I guess.
So I'll start from the beginning. Where did you grow up?
Yeah, I grew up in Port Moody, British Columbia, which isn't too far from Vancouver. Spent the majority of my youth there, and it was a pretty good spot to grow up, lots of outdoor spaces.
And what sort of activities and hobbies were you into growing up?
A lot of stuff. My parents, I was pretty lucky with my parents that wanted my brother and I and my stepsisters to be involved in a lot of stuff. So I know my mom had me in everything from like pottery to outdoor running and, you know, track cycling and all that kind of stuff. All of the girls and actually all the kids played soccer growing up as well. But I think the best part, maybe not specifically a sport, was just being allowed to like roam free with the neighborhood kids out in the forest behind the house, building forts and running around, which was pretty cool. And then a lot of street hockey. It was like the 90s, right? That was a thing to do for sure. And then into my teens, I did a lot more running and cycling and eventually got into climbing and been doing that for a long time.
I was also in pottery, so that's hilarious. But it is so much different now because you think of kids going out and it's like, the parents need to have some way to contact them and they need their cell phones. But growing up, it was just like, okay, I'm going out, I'll be back whenever. And then your parents would have no way of contacting you until you came back through the door.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure there were, you know, this is behind the Simon Fraser University. That's kind of where this big forested area was. I'm fairly certain there were bears and things back there. And there was always a parent that was loosely responsible for the kids. But it was definitely a traveling troop of children that were making forts and stuff like that. So it was pretty cool. Yeah, it was a neat place to grow up for sure.
And then I guess being on the West Coast, I find everything is sort of more outdoorsy here. People are into hiking and climbing and all of that sort of thing. So I guess you very much saw that growing up.
Yeah, for sure. And I think also, again, very fortunate growing up is my parents always had a boat. So we'd always disappear, especially during the summer, and head up to a marine park. And then again, you'd be let free to go kind of explore some small, you know, West Coast island or something like that. And two, I was in Air Cadets for 12 years old until I was 19, I guess, when I aged out. And that program was actually pretty cool in the number of random sports and outdoor activities that they introduced us to. So I definitely appreciated that program from that perspective as well.
Is that something that you wanted to join, or was that sort of a hobby that your mom signed you up for?
Oh, no, I don't know where this weird obsession came from, but pretty much as soon as my 12th birthday rolled around, this is like 1996, I'm aging myself here, I was definitely bothering my parents to let me go join the local 754 Phoenix Air Cadet Squadron. And I loved it. I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was the organization or just the people, but it was a really good program for me especially. And it was a relatively small squadron at the time, but they talked about planes and space and I could run around with these kids too. So I think it was just a good match of all the things that I like.
And so growing up before that, did you have in mind that you wanted to do something with aviation when you got older?
Yeah, again, I don't know where that came from. I bet you my mom would probably know, but it's always been an interest of mine. Birds and being outdoors and flying planes and stuff like that. My grandfather was a pilot in the Second World War. But I do specifically remember in grade, I think it was 6, Dr. Robert Thirsk came to my elementary school and he was a Canadian astronaut. He had just got back down from a shuttle mission of some kind. I remember listening to him and being like, okay, well, maybe I won't be an astronaut, but I certainly want to be a pilot. And so since then, it's been this pretty aggressive obsession, I think. And I got my pilot's license, my private pilot's license at 18, and I've just enjoyed it since then.
And then so with the Air Cadet program, did you learn to fly gliders first?
So you know what? I tried to get into that scholarship program. I wasn't successful, and I was running out of time because you age out of that program at 19. And I had applied for the Power Scholarship. I don't know what they call it now. And I think I had just the year left to get that sorted out. So it was sort of like this last Hail Mary. So I didn't do glider, but I was selected for or got the scholarship for Power in 2001, I think. That was a pretty pivotal moment in my life because it was challenging, just like school had always been challenging. I don't think lots of things came particularly easy to me. So it was definitely nice to have something so pivotal and so difficult under your belt at 18. It was important for me to finish that.
What was so difficult about it? Was it sort of the academics and, you know, calculations and that side of the house? Or was it the actual, you know, hands-on flying the airplane?
Less the hands-on stuff. That wasn't so much the problem. And even the academics weren't problematic. And I think this is something I've struggled with probably until maybe 2 years ago. And that's being underconfident. So while I look confident, maybe to people walking around or showing up to meetings and that kind of thing, there is a lot of effort to manage that. And I think when I was a teenager, that was even more difficult. So second guessing myself during a test or preparing for a test, that was always challenging. Presupposing that you're going to fail something and trying to fight your own brain with stuff like that. So that's been a challenge. That's probably the hardest thing about a lot of those things. And other things I've done since then is just working on my own self-doubt and managing that aspect.
It's so young to be a pilot and to do that. I would think that after you got your license, did that give you a lot of confidence in other areas of your life?
Maybe a little bit. It certainly opened a couple doors for me, I think, in terms of what I thought I was capable of, just because high school scholastically was difficult, not for a lack of trying. It's just I had a hard time in school with some things, especially math-based stuff, which is interesting given, you know, I have a master's in science now, but I think getting that was a sort of a small window into the fact that if you work really hard and try and manage that anxiety, there are lots of things you can do. And I think that helped moving forward into different careers.
At the drop zone where I skydive, one of the newer pilots is, I mean, I saw him and I was like, is this guy even old enough to fly a plane? And I just thought back to what I was doing at that age. And I was like, I was definitely not anywhere near that responsible.
I think what kind of did it was after I got that scholarship and I aged out of the program, I came back as a volunteer because there hadn't been a pilot at that unit in a number of years. So I figured this was my way to give back. And part of giving back was taking other kids that were 12, you know, up for a flight. And I'm 18, 19 doing this, flying kids in the lower mainland, you know, up from Boundary Bay or Chilliwack and places like that. So it was a huge amount of responsibility, which I don't think I recognized until recently when I was flying through the Vancouver airspace. I'm like, this was a lot for an 18-year-old with a bunch of other people's kids in the aircraft. But it all went well. And just, I think you slowly learn to rely on yourself that you are actually capable of some of these really difficult things. But it's not always an immediate realization, or it hasn't been for me. It's taken time to kind of reflect on that. And you're like, wow, I did actually do a thing that was pretty hard. I should probably apply that to the next step.
Once you get that pilot's license, how do you decide, or did you already have in mind that you wanted to go in the military, or did you ever think about maybe commercial aviation?
I was graduating high school right around 9/11, and that did a number, obviously, on the civil aviation industry. And so it was the job prospects were pretty pretty abysmal during that time. So the military seemed like it was a decent spot. And of course, all of the astronauts that I knew about at some point, except for some of the doctors, had been in the military. So I figured it was an option. And I did apply at 19. I didn't get in. So I went to community college and did some other stuff. But it was always in the back of my mind, because I think cadets, at least back then, was almost like a natural stepping stone for a lot of people. But yeah, my plan A was to join the military. It took until about plan E to actually get there, but eventually we did.
Yeah, you mentioned the other astronauts having gone through the military, and I just keep thinking about Chris Hadfield, and I'm a big Chris Hadfield fan. And in his book, he talks about when he was so young, how he decided he wanted to be an astronaut, and then sort of from that moment forward, everything he did was very calculated. How is this going to help me become an astronaut in the future?
Yeah, for sure. I've read a number of his books. In fact, he signed my logbook, which I thought was pretty cool. But he obviously had a plan and he was able to stick to it. I also had a plan, but it kept deviating from what I'd hoped to accomplish, which I think in the end has actually been super beneficial, because I've done so many random things and stuff that you wouldn't assume would be useful later on in life have popped up again as being pretty amazing. So while I had a specific plan, there's a lot of detours involved, but all of that experience is experience. But yeah, I think most of the things I chose to do were sort of in service to that goal of maybe one day getting to space or close to space. That's kind of why, like, I did get into the military when I was 19. So I went and studied geology, because that was another thing that, at least in the books I was reading in the 90s, astronauts were pretty well swept up in geology. So I had a great time working up north, doing surveys and sampling and that kind of stuff all over the place, actually, in northern BC, Alaska, northern Saskatchewan, down in Arizona, a bunch of random places. So that was an interesting experience. And at the same time, I don't know why, but the creative side of me decided I would maybe also open a clothing store and an art gallery in Vancouver to kind of exercise the other side of my brain. So taking something from your imagination and making it a tangible thing was actually a pretty neat skill to have. It didn't last forever, but I had all of these other experiences. And then during the recession, I kind of figured I'd apply again to the military. I got in, I didn't get in, but I did aircrew selection. I got selected, but I never heard back. So I ended up joining the Naval Reserve, which was another detour from this goal. But I actually had an amazing time in the Naval Reserves as a warfare officer and a diving officer, and learned a lot about myself in that training program, that you can work tired, you can work stressed out, you can work as a member of a team in the middle of the night in bad seas. You learn all these amazing skills and soft skills as well. And all of that worked out fairly well. And then they realized that they had actually offered me a contract, but they just didn't know how to get a hold of me because they changed my service number or something happened. And so I was able to take a transfer in 2013, and the rest is sort of history. So while it was, like I said, plan A was to go straight into the military and try this whole space thing, I ended up getting to piloting sort of via a circuitous route, but it worked out.
And so was that through HMCS Discovery that you joined the Naval Reserve?
Absolutely. Disco. What a great place.
Yeah, they have probably the best real estate in Vancouver. It's just such an amazing spot down there, like right on the edge of Stanley Park.
Oh, yeah. It was and a lot of really good people, too. So between HMCS Discovery and HMCS Malahat in Victoria, I finished all of my, well, back then it was MARS training, the Maritime Surface Officer Training. I think they call it Naval Warfare Officer now, but I was able to do all that. Had a really good time on the MCDVs. And again, it was one of those confidence building things, because a lot of that training was doing mental math in front of people to a fairly precise standard, because the captains always had the answers, but they wanted to see you do that math and figure out when you're going to regain your track and how long it's going to take. And so, yeah, I thought it was a good experience. I don't think I'd trade it, actually, having learned all these things along the way. I think it's been super beneficial for the job that I have now.
So I hear about people going through, at the time, I guess it would have been maybe MARS 4, and how that's such a difficult course. I am not a naval warfare officer, so I have no idea what it's like. What makes that course so challenging?
Yeah, good question. I know the program's changed a fair bit now, but back when I did it in about 2012 or so, it was very academic and mental math heavy, and you're working some pretty long watches as well on gross rotation. So you're constantly tired, you're constantly working. It still takes you 6 hours to make a nav route. So even when you're off watch, you still have all this work to do. And on top of that, you're working in all your recs. So you're in the motor room trying to figure out what those guys do. You're down working with the bosuns trying to figure out what those people do. So you're constantly busy. And I think it was just the amount of testing that you had to do, and how sort of I found it quite academically challenging as well. The amount kind of stuff you need to know to operate safely in pilotage waters and a minor warship. Like it was a lot of work, and a lot of it was in areas that I'm not great at, like mental math. That was a lot of work. We didn't lose too many people off the course, but there were definitely some times where I think we all had some doubts and second guessing ourselves, especially in some of the simulations that they run you through, where all of the things that can go wrong are going wrong, and they just want to see you make a decision, right?
Yeah, sometimes just making a decision is better than no decision at all. I like, there's this quote that I keep coming across, and it's like, the road of life is paved with flat squirrels who can make a decision because they go to cross the road and then they just freeze and they don't go one way or the other and then they get run over. But yeah, and then so as a naval warfare officer, just for those listening, there's sort of different subspecialties that they can get into, whether it's like being a NAVO or a DECO or a DIVO. So then how did you end up going on your dive course?
That's a good question. I was given the choice of being a general duty driver for the summer, which didn't sound super fun, or trying to do the dive course. You know what? That looks pretty cool. So it also ends up being a pretty awesome secondary duty because you have your primary tasks. And then, of course, depending on where you are, you'll have up to about 5 secondary duties. So that course too, I've always been a fairly fit individual, just doing random sports. But that course worried me a little bit because, believe it or not, I'm not a great swimmer and I was going on the dive course. So there was a fair bit of prep work. I actually pulled myself off the first time I tried it within just a couple days because I felt like I was going to be a liability to my team. Worked on my swimming for about another month or 2 months and then requested to try the course again, which is actually the first time I'd ever pulled myself off a course. But I was so worried about not being able to keep up as a good team member. That was my major motivation to try again when I had prepared a little bit better. I've never been a particularly strong swimmer, which is weird because I grew up around the water. But I think realizing that sooner rather than later and coming back and reattacking it, as much as it was I had to swallow my pride, it was helpful. And yeah, so it just became a nice secondary duty to have. And at that time, the rescue swimmer course was attached to the dive course as well. So on ship, you were on the list as a rescue swimmer as well. So it was nice to have that completed. You get your dolphins. That's pretty cool. And I'd briefly considered clearance diver for a little while, but shortly after I'd finished everything in 2013, my transfer came through anyway. So I ended up being a pilot instead.
So on the dive course, did you find it very physically challenging, and were there parts that you actually enjoyed about it?
I enjoyed the majority of the course. I definitely enjoyed all the snacks that we got, although I don't really like Oreos and plain cheddar cheese anymore. There was way too many calories of just that. But the swimming, that was the daily swim, was probably my weakest exercise that I had to do. I don't know what it was. As soon as we got in the water, everyone else was like 300 meters ahead and opening, and I was always behind. And I don't know what it was, maybe just poor swim technique. But on the run, I was one of the ones towards the front. So we always worked together. So if I were always made it in on time, but it was definitely slow on the swim, but the rest of the course understood that. And the folks that were slower at running, we all understood that and would go back and help them out on the daily run as well. So there was a trade. We all knew I was a terrible swimmer, but I was a good runner. So we were able to, there was like a trade that happened there. So it was a difficult course because it was 5 or 6 weeks of just constant exercise. And I'm a relatively small individual. I think at the time I was maybe 118 pounds. So when you have all of that kit on, just trying to waddle down the jetty, it was definitely challenging. And getting one of the guys, Andrew, out of the water, he's a big guy, the Zodiac drill to pull them into the boat. That was like max effort, you know, deadlift to get to get Andrew into the boat. But one of the things I appreciated about the course the most is the staff were like, I don't really care what gender you are. You're all divers. Just do your job. They're like, however you need to contort your body to get your diver into the boat, make it happen. So I appreciated that they pushed each of us where we needed to be pushed. And I know those staff, I'm sure they joked about how slow I was in that swim. And they made some, I can't repeat the jokes, but they made some pretty hilarious jokes about how slow I was. Mostly that they don't need a stopwatch, but they needed a sundial because I was so slow in the morning swims, but pushed through and had a good time on that course.
And so then you get the call to become a pilot. So then what does that training pipeline look like for you?
Yeah, so it was fairly typical for me. I transferred in 2013. I had a bit of a wait, which wasn't too bad. I ended up working at the Joint Rescue Coordination Center for a few months as a sort of trainee rescue coordinator, which again was a really interesting job for a bit. And that naval background helped out working with the Coast Guard. But I was enrolled under, I think, a now defunct program, the Seneca College program. It was the first year that they were running it where we would go to Seneca College for our academics to get a degree, but then go back and forth to the regional training schools for flight training. So we were pretty jam-packed. We had a jam-packed schedule for about 3.5 years. We went to phase one and then to school for a couple semesters in Toronto, then back for phase two in Moose Jaw, where I flew the Harvard. And then we had to go directly to whatever we were chosen for from phase two. So I was selected for helicopters, had about a couple weeks in between that course, and then went directly onto my helicopter training, which took about 8 months, which is pretty fast. And then we had to go back to school for another 3 or 4 semesters. So we got everything done, which is pretty fast. Like, I got very fortunate with the training pipeline in about 3.5 years.
And did you want helicopters, or was there a specific other type of aircraft that you would have preferred?
I mean, I think when I was a kid, because all the astronauts were jet pilots at the time, I was interested in jets. But when I got to phase two, flying the Harvard was awesome. Doing some of the low-level nav stuff and the aerobatics was pretty cool. But I think I got tainted by my flight commander, who was a former 427 pilot. And he was just talking about what he used to do. I'm like, that sounds pretty cool. Also, helicopters seem pretty neat. And so I was sort of torn between going maritime helo, just given my naval background. It seemed like it'd be a good fit because I didn't know much about the Army at all. So it seemed like supporting Army aviation, like TACHEL, seemed like a bit of a bridge too far because I didn't know anything about it. But my last semester of school, I was told that I'd probably be posted back to Moose Jaw because of some issues with the number of spots they had for people at units. And I'm like, you know what? I don't think I'm ready to be an instructor in Moose Jaw. Like, I would have just finished and graduated with my wings. I'm not sure that's the best place for me. So I hunted around. I contacted my old flight commander from Moose Jaw as well. And he's like, you should just put in your notice of intent at 427 and give it a try. He's like, I think you got the brain for it, whatever that means. And so I did, and I did the selection flight and the interview, and I happened to get picked up at 427. And one of my goals was to be operational and to go on a tour or two pretty much as quickly as possible before you get streamed in the Air Force, having to go somewhere else or promoted and your flying career ends. So I was surprised that I got selected at 427, just knowing the folks, some of the folks there, and I wasn't super confident with my flying, but I swear that selection flight remains one of my best flights of all time. I don't know what happened. I was just very calm because I didn't think I'd get picked up. So I just enjoyed being there and I had a great time. And then, yeah, I got the message that I was posted and was quite surprised, but it worked out.
Yeah, sometimes that's like when if you feel like you don't have anything to lose, it's like that's when you're the most relaxed and that's when everything happens. But is that a little bit atypical to have someone so new flying at 427?
I think it used to be. I don't exactly know, but I do know that for a while there was some requirements in terms of number of hours they'd want you to have before you even applied. But I think like everywhere else across the Air Force, that we're drawing from the same pool. So there is still a selection process at 427, but there are more pipeline pilots now. But that's just because everyone has to take pilots at this point. We're still part of one wing, right? We have to accept TACHEL pilots, or at least their applications, because everyone needs a spot to be posted to right now, and the other squadrons are filling up a little bit. So there is a constant back and forth that happens with that. But pipeliners are a little bit more commonplace now.
This is a silly question because I don't know anything about helicopters, but what does TACHEL mean?
Oh, tactical helicopter. So there's obviously different communities in the Canadian Armed Forces and the RCAF. Tactical aviation are the helicopter units that are primarily involved in supporting the Army, or in our case, we specifically support CANSOFCOM. The other helicopter communities, maritime helicopters, they specifically support the Navy. And then there's the search and rescue community as well. They have a very specific mandate for domestic search and rescue. So TACHEL, we're a little bit of an offshoot from that community, being SOF in particular, but that's essentially where our roots come from.
And then I guess, would that require different skills as a pilot? Like maybe people, I guess, rappelling or jumping or doing that sort of thing that maybe a maritime helicopter wouldn't be doing?
Not so much as a pilot, but I think you have to be interested in the type of mandate that that community has. So if you are a TACHEL pilot and you really enjoy working with the Army and being forward with them or working with your ground force in SOF, you are so closely embedded with those members that you almost feel like you're an extension of that. So the great folks at 408, we hear about them digging trenches and doing rec marches and armying harder than the Army sometimes, it feels like. And similarly, 430 Squadron at Valcartier, they work with the Vendée a lot as well. And so that those are the relationships that they build because those are the people that they're supporting. And in CANSOFCON, we work with our other units in the command to support them specifically. So I don't know if there's a specific skill set. I think you just have to enjoy the mandate. It's the same thing with the maritime helicopter folks. I'm sure they probably have to enjoy being on boats because that's primarily what they do, right?
And then being in CANSOFCOM, would that mean that you were sort of deployed more often than maybe a typical Army unit?
I think that would depend on what's happening that year. I've been deployed in a four-year career, specifically at that unit. I've been deployed twice. And I think it just depends on what the Air Force requires at that time and sort of what CANSOFCOM is involved in. I think, though, that our rotation schedule, we're pretty similar with the rest of the TACHEL units, though. But yeah, we do certainly deploy a fair bit.
And then, so talk to me about your next posting to the Johnson Space Center.
Oh my gosh, I'm super excited about that. And that was an amazingly random story. There was a selection or solicitation message that came out. We were busy doing a training program for our new candidates domestically. And I'm a busy opso. My head's in this ops game. I'm trying to make sure that people are, you know, at the helicopters at the right time with the right amount of fuel. And my OC, she suggested that I apply for this job. I'm like, boss, I'm not going to get it. There are so many overqualified people that are going to get this job working at Mission Control on behalf of the RCAF and working with the Canadian astronauts. And she's like, I will manage your OPSO piece if you get your letter written and just apply for this job because you will regret it. So I owe my OC a fair bit of gratitude for making sure that I actually sat down and wrote that letter. And the majority of that job is supporting the Canadian astronauts at the Johnson Space Center. That includes the two RCAF officers down there, Colonel Hansen and Colonel Kirtrick, and the two civilian CSA astronauts as well, Dr. Saidi Gibbons and Dr. Saint-Jacques as well. And a large portion of that job will be working in Mission Control as the CAPCOM, which is a person who communicates on behalf of Mission Control to the ISS. So you are call sign Houston, responsible for the comms, which is pretty crazy. And I'm very excited about that because generally you will sit the CAPCOM console as an astronaut in training. So it's very unusual to have a non-American and a non-astronaut sitting in that role. So I'm super honored, super excited, also mildly terrified because that is a big responsibility, right? But yeah, my room is packed up right now. Like I'm ready to go. I'm very excited.
That is so cool. And you know, when I was in Ottawa for International Women's Day and talking to the women there, and sort of the one thing that they were saying about CANSOFCOM, but it carries over to everything else as well, is like, don't self-select yourself out of something. Like, apply for it, go for it, and then let them decide if you have what it takes or whether or not they want you. Because I think, you know, we do sort of have that imposter syndrome sometimes, like, oh, someone else will get it, someone else is more qualified. But then here you are, if you hadn't done that, then obviously you wouldn't be going to do this job.
Yeah, no. And I think it's the same thing with CANSOFCOM too. I think there exists this mystique and this idea that there's only one type of person that joins CANSOFCOM. When I look at my graduating class from our selection course, everybody there is different. And we're not just talking about gender orientation or sort of religious affiliation. There are people that have completely different backgrounds. And I think the reason why, I don't know if it's intentional, but one thing that's amazing about that is that because we're all so unique and have such a different perspective, we can think around abstract problems and can be very flexible that way. So while you might not think you meet the criteria or maybe you're not the right type of person, I think you're right. I think you can self-select to your own detriment. So you might as well just go for it. Although I think being a lifelong space nerd with a master's in space science, I've been working a space portfolio in CANSOFCOM probably made me a little bit eligible, but yeah, it was a super, super cool opportunity that I'm very, very honored to have been selected as the first person to sit that job.
And so how long will this position be? Is it like 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, so it's a 3-year outcan with the potential for 4 years. So one of my big jobs while I'm down there, aside from obviously learning how to to be a good CAPCOM is also trying to develop the position as well. Because I think one of the things we're hoping to do is to make sure the rest of the CAF, or the Canadian Armed Forces, understands how important space assets are. So part of the job, as I see it, will be talking about space to anybody that will listen, which is very exciting for me, especially if I get to sit down with some operational level commanders and tell them why space is important and sort of share that excitement too with folks through the CSA on the civilian side as well.
So while you're in that position and being a pilot in the CAF, do you have to fly every so often just to maintain your qualification, or how does that work for you as a pilot?
So that is sort of up for negotiation right now. Unfortunately, it does mean I likely won't fly, or if I do, it'll be with a different category. So right now I'm a special operations aircraft commander, but that is, there's a lot of testing and yearly evaluations that happen with that. And it's a pretty big draw on resources, and I'll be too occupied, I think, down in Houston to try and come up and meet all of those criteria. So I might see if I can maintain a utility aircraft commander qualification, which is a little bit less burdensome, but it's really going to depend on how busy that job is. So I might unfortunately have to let my pilot category lapse. And when we figure out where I'm going in 3 years, we can reattack. It's unfortunate, but at the same time, I think I'm happy to let that go if it means I get to go work at NASA for a couple years and then bring that experience back and try and remember how to fly a helicopter.
I'd say that's a pretty good trade-off. And then, so if they do open up like another astronaut selection, is that something that you are going to apply for?
I mean, I won't say no. I did apply in 2017, but I wouldn't have been competitive. Like, I actually know I would not have been competitive. I wasn't, obviously, I wasn't selected. But I certainly, again, wouldn't self-select myself out from that if they open it up again. I may be thinking, and this is what I do, and my boss currently, she's going to be mad that I said this, but I am thinking of maybe doing a PhD by correspondence and as well, which just means I'll be uber busy again. And that might make my application a little bit better. But at this point in time, I think I'm just happy to be working with astronauts and in a role that they often occupy. So it might be as close as I ever get, and I'll be pretty pumped about that. I think 9-year-old me watching Dr. Robert Thirst talk about space would be pretty proud of how far I've come.
Yeah, that is pretty awesome. And then, so you mentioned the PhD, would that be just to be more competitive in that? Or is that sort of personal interest? Are you one of those people that always has to be doing some sort of education?
Yeah, I mean, you can't see my room, but it's littered with books. So I think I'm just one of those people that really likes learning. And that's probably why I decided to torture myself with a master's degree for the past 3 years, which also meant I did a fair bit of thesis writing while deployed overseas, flying every day and doing other stuff. So it might just be a glutton for punishment, but I do like deep diving into subjects. So if I can find someone I might be able to work with for a PhD, I definitely consider it, but we'll have to see again. Obviously my primary job is supporting the astronauts, and if there's no time left over for that, then that's also okay.
I've been slowly picking away at these RMC courses just to hopefully have a degree by the time I'm 80. And I find like sometimes I'll sign up for one and then I'll have to drop it because I feel like I get so busy at work and then I won't have time for it. But obviously my life is probably not nearly as busy as yours as a, you know, a deployed pilot and CANSOFCOM and all that. So how do you balance that, doing a master's while you're doing all of that stuff?
You know, that's a good question. So yeah, doing a master's, being a pilot and being an operations officer at a busy squadron might have been pretty close to my limit, but it came down to really good time management and a lot of really good support from the people that I work with as well, that, you know, again, my OC or my deputy OC, if they saw me working too late, they would send me home. I'm pretty sure they actually wrote my academic leave pass for me last November so I could go defend. And they were pretty flexible as well. And I think if you choose, it depends on what you want to do, but the school that I went to, the University of North Dakota and their space science program, they were super flexible, which helped as well because I knew I was going to have a very erratic schedule. Sometimes you get, you know, just a few days notice to kind of be ready to go somewhere. So I was able to sort of take things that matched my schedule, which is super chaotic. And I had some professors that allowed me to kind of work at my own pace, which was good. And it also depends on what you want to do. So I chose a thesis in an area that I knew I could study remotely. It didn't involve a lot of experimentation or data collection, really. So it wasn't exactly what I wanted to do, but it was what I could manage when I was busy doing other stuff. And a supportive family as well, and a really good roommate who would buy me snacks when I was freaking out at home. So I think it also depends on your support and your motivation as well, right? Like, do you actually want to study what you're studying? That makes a big difference.
I mean, that's a big thing for me too, is that I'm not doing it for a specific purpose or goal. It's like, I'm doing it to have to, you know, just in case there's a job I want in the future that requires a degree, but it's not, there's no like specific end target. So then that means that that gets put to the back burner, like whenever my regular job gets too busy to do that.
Yeah. Well, this will be, I've done three, I think a PhD would be number four, but I'll probably stop at that point. But I think the motivation piece and figuring out exactly why it is you want to do that makes a big difference. I don't think I would have been able to manage that kind of course load for 3 years while working in such a busy place if I didn't absolutely love space so much that I go to work, fly, do whatever I need to do as an opso, exercise, eat dinner, come home, and then spend 4 hours in class or whatever. Like, if I didn't like it, I wouldn't have done it probably, right?
And then, so as a Reg Force member, I'm not completely sure how it works because I'm a reservist, but do you get funding from the military to pay for these further education?
Yeah. So I got pretty lucky because the military, when I enrolled, paid for another bachelor's degree as part of that Seneca program. And then I guess in 2018 or so, I applied for the individual learning plan for a master's degree. And if you can sort of make a case that that degree would be beneficial to the CAF, and like it was, I created a position in CANSOFCOM that specifically relates to space. So that's been helpful. The military paid for the entirety of my master's degree. I don't know if they pay for US schools anymore. I think I was grandfathered into that. But another factor too is like, I don't know if I would have finished it if I had to pay as much as US schools cost in order to get that degree. So it was certainly beneficial and pretty awesome, actually. I think the only restriction I had is that I couldn't choose to leave the military the same year that I got the degree, which wasn't my plan anyway. But yeah, having it funded even partially is pretty amazing. And I think they still have the ILP program. It's called something else now, but there's definitely funding available for members that want a graduate degree.
Yeah, I know a few people recently have done degrees through like King's College in London. And I'm assuming that they used the ILP or whatever it's called now to do that. So I think they do still do some international programs.
Some of them are pretty specific to military members as well. I think King's College has like a very specific like aerospace one for military members and a military history one as well. They got a bunch of cool programs. I looked at that school as well, but obviously space science one. But yeah, I think it's something that people are interested in. I would certainly recommend it, even if you only get partway through, if the military can sponsor it and it's something that you can maybe apply in your job in the military, like why not?
Yeah, for sure. And then when you mentioned your time management there, you mentioned working out and staying fit. So what do you do to keep yourself fit? I noticed on your pictures on Instagram that you have basically a rock climbing wall in your house.
It's not in the living room. It was in my bedroom because it seemed the most convenient. But I did a lot of running. In fact, I did it was an all women's team that I had, and we ran from Petawawa to the tomb of the unnamed soldier, unmarked soldier. I can't remember what it's called, but that the memorial downtown Ottawa. So it was like 174K run, and the eight of us ran a marathon or so, or half marathon, to raise money for wounded warriors there. So running's always been important, and I found a way to like make it even more beneficial to society by making a fundraiser out of it. And then I volunteered a lot with the local climbing club because climbing, I find, is probably the best way for me to clear my mind. So it was a pretty important part of my life. And even overseas, I convinced the camp sergeant major to let me build a small climbing wall on our side of the camp there, which is pretty cool. So I was able to climb overseas as well, which is pretty neat. So climbing, ice climbing, running, that kind of stuff. I still do a fair bit of that.
Awesome. Do you do any like general weight training or CrossFit or anything like that? Or mostly just sort of like the body weight stuff and running?
I have a really cool coach, and I gave her all of these competing goals. Like, I want to be a better climber, but I want to squat more, and I want to be a long distance runner. And I don't know how she accommodated all of those three completely different tasks and goals. For the job as well, I know I mentioned a little while ago about not wanting to be a liability as a diver. So I pulled myself off the course. I still have that in the back of my mind with this job as well. Like I have to work at a pretty high percentage of my body weight, wearing an armored vest and with your pistol and stuff like that, and your helmet and NVGs and everything else. So as a small individual, I take that fitness pretty seriously. So anywhere I can build strength, I think it's important, not just for longevity and health, but I think it makes me better at my job as well.
And so that coach, is that through the military or is that a civilian coach?
This particular person, she used to work for PSP, but she's just finishing up her PhD in kinesiology and she has her own business now. But she does work privately with a bunch of CANSOFCOM members and other folks, high performance folks. So she and my physio that I used to see a fair bit have been pretty instrumental in keeping me healthy for my job, because helicopter flying, especially as a small person with all that heavy equipment and the really odd position you have to sit in for so long. It's known to definitely cause some issues over time, but I think the climbing has actually maybe insulated me a little bit from those serious neck and back injuries because of you know, the strength that you build from climbing.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you have like specific neck exercises that you do, or have you had neck troubles from that? Because I heard that a lot of people who work sort of in and around helicopters, just because of the weight of everything, causes a lot of neck issues.
Yeah, so it's pretty, I'd heard about these issues previously, and they were pretty good when I was on my phase training in phase three. They didn't give us anything specific, but they're like, go to the gym, work on your shoulder mobility, back mobility, you know, lower end stuff. So they were at least hinting to the fact that this is something you might want to do. And being a little bit overboard with stuff on occasion, I'm like, I'm going to hire a coach to make sure that I stay safe. So I've been relatively lucky, knock on wood. And again, I think it's just because of that pretty serious commitment to those few sports that have kept me fairly mobile. And as soon as there's an issue, I've brought it up and have got some help with it, but nothing terrible. So I think it's, honestly, I think it's been the climbing and the fact that I have a pre and post flight routine that my coach gave me as well to make sure that we're activating the right muscles. And a close friend of mine as well used to be a physio. So it was helpful to have her around as well, just to manage little tweaks here and there.
Okay. And so what does this pre and post flight routine look like? Is it just sort of little exercises and some mobility maybe?
It kind of looks like mobility stuff, but it's mobility specific to certain muscle groups that are going to be overburdened while you're flying with that heavy helmet on, leaning forward. And most of us lean to the left with one leg extended. I know you can't see me doing this on the podcast, but it's this really odd seating position that you have to maintain for a long time. So the new style, it seems like, and a lot of people in the command, including leadership, are realizing this is a problem and are taking it. They're taking it seriously that this is something we need to prevent. So these pre and post exercises, a lot of mobility. Everyone I know has a foam roller. A lot of people wear back braces. Those not for weightlifting, but the ones you can get at the drugstore just for a bit of support under your vest. And you'll see a lot of people with pillows, little cushions behind their back as well to take some of that strain. So I think it's sort of the new style is people my age and a little younger are very concerned about mobility and that kind of thing. So it's just become habit. And also CrossFit, I think, has helped with that too. There's a lot of stretching and mobility in CrossFit. And almost everyone I know except me does CrossFit. So this is like a common thing now. You'll see people doing stretches before they go flying. But it's a lot like a F1 driver. You'll see them do exercises before they're in that really high performance position for so long. So I think that's kind of where people are going with it. It's not just helicopter flying. You are essentially doing a sport while you're in that helicopter. It's a very specific position. So the high performance cell in CANSOFCOM takes that stuff pretty seriously between nutrition and the PSP exercise folks we have access to as well. They'll come up with a personalized program if you want one to keep you in tip top shape. So that's certainly appreciated.
Yeah, I'm definitely getting to the age now where, you know, hauling around the dive tanks for a while and then wearing the gear that I do now, it's like my back and my hip are definitely feeling it. It is so important to do that stuff and to do it sort of before you get to that point where it starts to be detrimental in your everyday life.
Yeah, and I think starting early is important. And this is something that I'm seeing, at least local leadership. And like I said, you're seeing it a bit more at the schools now too. And they're taking a lot of time to make sure, and like, it's a helicopter. It was built in the 90s. There's not a lot of modification you can make to the actual equipment itself, but there are things you can do while you're in the helicopter to alleviate some of that stress. And we're finding that out now and really trying to attack it, because it takes, what, $10 million maybe to make a pilot? Like, why would you want to lose them to back injuries? So we're definitely working on that.
If everything could go your ideal way after you're posting to the Space Center, what are your goals for the future?
Oh man, you know what? A lot of people have asked me that, and I don't actually have a great answer. I feel like there's a lot of doors that could open with this particular program. I'm obviously have a bit of a soft spot for CAN-SOFCOM, and I'm being posted out of the command for the duration of this OutCAN. But I do have an interest in coming back and flying again and seeing if I can incorporate some of the operational knowledge working in another sort of high performance, no fail environment and bring that back to CAN-SOFCOM. But I guess part of that too will be up to the career manager as well and where they might need another pilot. But I don't have a specific wish list. I think I'm going to keep that door open to see what happens. And I'm pretty much just focused on the next 3 years, I think.
Do you think you'll stay in the Canadian Forces until the end of your career?
Well, I've been in for 13 years now, so I have a bit of time left. But yeah, it honestly depends. I'm happy to serve for another couple of years. Like I said, I want to bring back some of that knowledge and sort of move into that next phase of my career where you're kind of mentoring new people, because I kind of just moved out of that particular portion of my career where you're constantly the student. So it'll be neat to be on the other side of that when I'm done at NASA there. So to answer your question, no idea, but I'd certainly like to see how I can share the knowledge I'll be getting down south there and see how we can apply it in the CAF.
You mentioned sort of working in these no-fail environments. So when you are flying or doing something that is this high stress, no fail, and it's very chaotic, what do you employ or what sort of methods do you have to like keep calm and think through the situation and work through it?
My experience with this is pretty much limited to flying with CAN-SOFCOM, and I think it's the level of preparation and how much training we do. So there's very rarely a time when I felt like I was approaching a point, even deployed, where I was getting close to being at my limit, at least in an operational capacity. Certainly training, they'll try and stress you out as much as possible, which I think is important. But I think it's the preparation, and you also know that your team is just as prepared as you are. So I think it's being able to rely on that crew. It's not just you as the pilot. You have a flight engineer, and you often have a door gunner as well, and another pilot that you're working with. So there's four people that you can offload tasks to. Sorry, three other people you can offload tasks to if you need to. And it's about communication, I think, and trusting that you can be in a moment vulnerable with someone and say, listen, I'm out of my depth, I need help. And that person will be there to step in. So I think for me, that's what it's been, is there's been a couple of times where I voiced concern that I was struggling with something or is having trouble in the aircraft and there was someone there to help out. And even if you're the aircraft commander, that's, you got to work with your first officer as well as a team to offload those tasks. And I think that's probably how I've managed it, is an awful lot of preparation. And you know that everyone else in that aircraft is just as prepared as you are.
And then so throughout your career, like, have you faced any like barriers that you felt like for maybe being a woman in that environment or anything like that, that you felt like were really difficult to overcome? And if so, how did you overcome that?
I think I often get more commentary, strangely, in public when I've been out at Remembrance Day in my uniform or something. I'm not out in it very often. And I get questions from the public as to how it is that I have a pair of wings or whatever like that, sort of intimating that I didn't earn them like everyone else. But I think, especially in my time both in the Navy and in CAN-SOFCOM, the barriers that have been placed in front of me have more or less been self-induced. And you're talking a little bit before about that lack of confidence. And I think some people will read that as being very anxious. And I've worked on that a fair bit. But to be honest, I don't think I've encountered anything that I would sort of say was directly related to my gender orientation or anything like that. There's definitely been personalities that I did not get along with. It's very few and far between. But just like anywhere else, you find a way to either work with them or just find a way to sort of mitigate that. But those experiences have been relatively minimal in my experience. And for the most part, if I've struggled with something, it's been because I've doubted myself more than anything.
I'm sort of the same way. And, you know, I get sometimes in my head, it's like if I'm having trouble with something, I start thinking like, oh, well, the guys are going to think like, oh, it's because she's a woman that she can't, you know, and they're not thinking that at all, but I'm just making this up in my head. And so that it's like, you know, we have to learn kind of not to do that sometimes and not to like make up these narratives of things that other people might be thinking.
For sure. And that's not to discount people that have encountered that before. And I know I've got a bit of side eye on occasion, but you're just yourself, you show up prepared, you do your job. And I think for the most part, 99% of my 13 years at this point, I've been met with the same level of respect. And those instances have been very few and far between. And some of those personalities I've encountered, they weren't just having issues with me, they had issues with everybody. So pretty rare. So I've been pretty lucky with that, I think.
So with your climbing, what is like your dream destination to go climbing?
Oh man. Well, I went to Mallorca a couple of years ago. That was pretty amazing. To be honest, I haven't done a lot of alpine climbing in the Rockies. I'd like to go there. She and I had been planning a trip to Chamonix. We didn't make it to France this year, but that would be nice too. There's some definite classic lines I'd like to see before I die. But there's a lot of stuff just in our backyard here in Canada that I can't really complain about. There's some excellent quality alpine climbs in the Rockies I'd like to get my hands on.
Yeah, a lot of good stuff, you know, down in the Pacific Northwest and Washington as well. I did Mount Rainier a few years ago, and that was awesome. I'd like to sort of go and do a little bit more of that. I feel like I should be taking a little bit more advantage of living in Victoria right now, but sometimes things just get busy. But I mentioned this on another podcast, I was watching this show about Chamonix and like the rescue there. It's so insane because people just, they go there with no experience and it's just like accepted that they will fall into a crevasse and that they'll have to go get rescued. And these guys are just working, like the helicopter pilot will like drop some guys at one spot, go pick someone up, take them to the hospital, go back and get the other guys. And they're so close to the mountain, like when they're hovering, and it's just insane flying. I'm sure you'd probably appreciate that as a helicopter pilot.
I mean, I've done some pretty crazy stuff, but some of those rescue pilots and like props to the SAR community in Canada as well, both civilian and military, they do some insane stuff in crazy weather to try and get people. And yeah, you're right. I think you need to be prepared, you know, take a couple classes on crevasse rescue before you try and cross a glacier. But yeah, those are pretty impressive pilots all around. And maybe as a retirement job, I'd consider that. That'd be pretty sweet.
Yeah. And then you could just go climbing on your off hours. So like as a Griffin pilot in the CAF or as any sort of helicopter pilot, do people ever transfer from sort of one sort of helicopter to the other? Or are you just sort of on that same airframe like throughout your career?
Generally, they like to retain you in the same community because there is a lot of institutional knowledge that it takes time to build. The amount of stuff we need to know in each of the communities, every community is different, but there's a specialty involved there. And it's a lot of time and effort to build competent aircraft commanders and air crew in those communities. So while I don't think making a change between communities is necessarily discouraged, I don't see it happening too often. But I know that it does happen. We've had a couple of people from our unit go SAR. We've had a couple of people from our unit go to fixed wing to go fly Hercules and that kind of thing. So it definitely happens. It's just, you also get comfortable in your machine as well, right? I think the Griffin and I, it's taken about 1300 hours or so for us to, you know, like each other. We're comfortable with each other now. It'd be tough, I think, you know, to learn a new community because it is a lot of academic knowledge, a different type of flying. It certainly happens though. And it's usually a discussion with the crew manager. Sometimes life happens, you need to move somewhere. Like maybe one day it'd be nice to go back to Vancouver where I grew up and or the Victoria area and sort of fly in a different community, but definitely happens. Personal preference, I guess. I think I'm fairly happy with the Griffin at this point, though. Like I said, we just got to the point where we like each other now.
Awesome. So my final question that I always ask everyone, what advice would you give to women looking to join the Canadian Forces? And then in this case, specifically those wanting to become pilots?
I'd say give it a try. Have an idea of what you think you might want to do. So definitely reach out, ask people, try and find someone who can put you in touch with a pilot who's working in a community you might be interested in. Like I said, I kind of stumbled into the selection process for CANSOFCOM, and I wish I'd known more about it before by having asked a couple more questions. I certainly think it's a job that most people can do if they're dedicated and willing to make mistakes and learn from them, because flying a helicopter is just a series of small mistakes that you're correcting all the time. Those machines are insane. But I definitely think it's a rewarding career. It's a lot of work, but I have done some pretty awesome and amazing stuff as a helicopter pilot in CANSOFCOM specifically. So I'd love to see more women flying, and maybe it's just a matter of getting the word out there.
Awesome. Well, hopefully this podcast will help do that. So thank you so much for your time today, and like best of luck to you in your new posting. And I hope that you have an amazing experience doing that. And I look forward to hearing about all of your adventures.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate the time. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you for listening. The biggest way to help support this podcast is to leave a rating and review on your Apple Podcasts and Spotify apps. You can also visit my Instagram page at Shoot Like a Girl Podcast to see photos from the guests, keep up to date with the podcast, and find out about any merchandise releases.